Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to New Books in Environmental Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Iyad Hassami, a host of the channel, and my research is a doctoral student in the School of English at the University of Leeds. I'm working on ecology and agriculture in mid-20th century Lebanon, and my project is supported by the UK Arts and Humanities Research Council through the White Rose College of the Arts and Humanities. Today on the show, we'll be talking with Max Ayel about his new book, A People's Green New Deal. Max, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
I wonder if you could begin the interview by telling us a little bit about yourself.
I am currently a postdoctoral fellow at Wageningen University's Rural Sociology Group in the Netherlands, as well as associated researcher with the Tunisian Observatory for Food Sovereignty and the Environment, and an editor with Labor and Society and Agrarian South. My current work is on the intellectual history of heterodox theories of development, emerging especially from Tunisia, but also to a certain extent from Egypt, and the cross-fertilization of these ideas across North and West Africa through the hub of Dakar, especially through the work of Samir Amin and the cluster of institutions he was working with. And I'm especially focusing on alternative technology, alternative forms of development, which is very different from some of the contemporary talk around alternatives to development. And I'm also working on a manuscript about the national liberation movement in Tunisia and the role of peasants in driving that national liberation movement in the context of the peasant role in worldwide decolonization during that period.
Wonderful. Well, it's really wonderful to speak with you today. And let's turn now to your book, A People's Green New Deal. Let's hear the origin story of this book. How did you come to write it?
So I always tell people that this book was essentially an accident. I should have been working on my work, focusing on my work on the intellectual history of heterodox theories of development. And I, quite by happenstance, was writing a bit on the ecological debate in the global north about a Green New Deal when Ocasio-Cortez dropped her Green New Deal. And because I've been writing for the public on a variety of topics, usually related somehow to development, imperialism, ecology, climate, I attempted to publish a few articles and book reviews on the topic that took what I thought was not the particularly radical step of actually assessing who Ocasio-Cortez was, reading the actual context and text of what her Green New Deal was saying, looking at the institutional networks it was bound to, and thinking about how that was articulating with prevailing social democratic or democratic socialist politics in the imperial core in the United States and to a lesser extent in Britain. And this was, in fact, a reaction to the fact that it was there was an aggressive hyping going on over the Ocasio-Cortez Green New Deal that was really being represented as eco-socialist. And I thought this was just a ludicrous statement on its face. And if you actually look at what's going on now, right, everyone totally forgot the Ocasio-Cortez was supposed to be an eco-socialist. This is no longer part of the discussion. But at the time, it was perceived or proposed or promulgated to be sectarian to actually assess what was actually going on with Ocasio-Cortez. And so I had a number of articles that were just flat out rejected. They said, we're not interested in this approach. And I was quite taken aback. I said, wow, this seems like a very important, or at least an approach that should be a part of the overall debate about political ecology in our current moment. Is it going to be a priori disallowed from entering the public sphere? And the answer to that was evidently yes. So I decided if I cannot get this perspective out via the wide array of journals, then I'm going to see if I can write a book about it. So I wrote to David Shulman at Pluto, and he was very supportive. And I spent the next 8 months writing a book about it.
Wow. So let's stay with the Imperial Core. John Maynard Keynes and Thomas Robert Malthus. These two figures and their legacies haunt your book. I would like to ask you about how you understand the manifestations of their ideas in the public debate around the climate development social welfare nexus, as you call it. Why do these two figures matter, and how do you use their legacy to describe and distinguish trends in the discourse to which you are contributing? And how does the thought of Ursula K. Le Guin, who also towers as a muse in your book, interact with Keynesian and Malthusian ideas?
So Keynes was basically offering a theoretical perspective on how to respond to the Great Depression, amongst other things. And he basically said, okay, the state needs to engineer a large amount of spending, of countercyclical spending, in order to escape from the Great Depression, which is, of course, ultimately what happened. Now, it has been essentially suppressed in the discussion of the Green New Deal that the proposals for a Green New Deal were, first of all, originally conceived as jobs for all programs. And that, second of all, these were conceived as a kind of ecological green Keynesianism that was supposed to propel a kind of retrenchment and reindustrialization of the US and, to a lesser extent, the UK economies. And so lurking behind them is the notion of how exactly the ruling class should respond to, one, the pervasive deindustrialization, which is ongoing in the core, and associated industrialization, which is occurring in East Asia, in particular China, and how the deindustrialization, in fact, represents a systemic threat in a certain sense to the long-term permanence of Anglo-American hegemony within the world system. So this was sort of one response. And it's kind of been kind of quietly inherited among some of the social democratic propositions, which say, okay, we're going to carry out a wide range of countercyclical social programs. We're going to partially decommoditize. We're going to go further and partially decommodify certain spheres of public life. We're going to put certain forms of the ecology off limits to capitalist desecration and externalization of costs. But this will be a proposal that will explicitly not take on capitalism, at least for 20 years, which is the same thing as not taking on capitalism at all. So that's the background of that aspect of the book. Malthus was not a consistent theorist, and he's often deployed in very cynical ways to attack the ecological movement. I mean, Malthus was, first of all, primarily concerned with elaborating a kind of ramshackle, ad hoc, or post hoc theoretical justifications for denying alms to the poor. And he said, well, the poor will tend to overbreed and we shouldn't encourage that and kindred notions. So in contemporary climate chatter, Malthusianism is basically deployed against the notion that there are some form of flexible but still existent ecological limits to the Earth system. So if you say, okay, there's a limit to how many resources we can reasonably access, for example, for renewable transition, people say, okay, that's a Malthusian perspective. It's quite the opposite, not least because there's a way of articulating the position that there are a limit to easily accessible resources to point out that both those limits and the cost of accessing resources represent distributional problems. And those of us raising this issue point out that we don't want to extract these resources and impose their costs on the weakest sectors of the world population, the most vulnerable sectors of the world population. This is an anti-internationalist politics. So it's kind of topsy-turvy that Malthusianism is deployed then as a stick to beat people who have some sort of cognizance of the role of the ecology and the fact that the ecology is not indefinitely kind of reformable by technology. It's ironic this is being used to kind of assault people who have a popular eco-socialist orientation whether it's a popular internationalist and anti-imperialist eco-socialist orientation or otherwise. Malthusianism is basically deployed to attack any and all kind of notions of eco-socialism or degrowth, which is anti-capitalist and is increasingly shifting in the direction of eco-socialism, although there are certain barriers which remain to be surmounted to affect that convergence. Ursula Gunn helps us see the future. Part of the problem, I think, of both of the above theorists is they block a way of reconceiving of the future in a way that is can make the world big enough for everybody. Now, of course, Ursula Le Guin's utopias have always historically been ambiguous, which I think is helpful in the sense that building utopia under capitalism is inherently an ambiguous endeavor, because you actually have to build utopia or struggle for socialism, is a vocabulary that I prefer to hold on to, under conditions that are not of your own choosing, which therefore distorts inevitably any and all projects for socialist transition. And so this idea of both holding on to utopia and thinking seriously about utopia, and also understanding that utopia will be what she called a flawed utopia, which also means the struggle for utopia will be flawed, is, I think, a helpful corrective to a lot of prevailing thinking, which will attack both utopian thinking on the whole, and they'll say, oh, that's not pragmatic, that's not reasonable, that's not possible. And will also at the same time attack the movements that are struggling towards utopia from their own particular position as irredeemably flawed, precisely because they are blighted by the conditions of their birth, and also blighted by the resistance and oppressions that capitalism and imperialism inflict upon them as they attempt to walk to utopia. And so the heat of this assault will inevitably warp some of these institutions. And that's actually in their very nature. That's in the nature of struggle. So I think she is very helpful about that. I think something else that she is doing that is quite remarkable and important is she is bringing our focus to softer utopias in a certain sense. That is, she is, although kind of the austere worlds that she usually uses to build utopia are more austere than the conditions humanity faces on this earth, to be sure. But what I think is important is to say, okay, you can actually have a utopia which embraces high technology, which embraces sophisticated social interdependence, which is modern in many senses, but which at the same time does not turn technology or turn a particular Jetsonian vision of modernity into a goal in and of itself or a virtue in and of itself, but that rather we should understand that the technical system and the social system are both embedded, interweaving, constitute one another, and that also you can have a utopia which is not resting on these kind of Jetsonian or Star Wars, Star Trek style, extremely advanced and, in fact, in the current period, non-existent technical systems, and that we can have softer, more grounded utopias that recognize that, in fact, the utopia is meant to serve humans rather than the other way around.
I really like what you were saying about ambiguity in her worlds. Let's move from theory to plans. In your first chapter, Great Transition or Fortress Eco-Nationalism, you draw attention to how top-down, world-scale ecological financial engineering plans have gained traction as part of an effort to mitigate risk and contain the so-called threat multiplier of climate change or global warming. How do the contemporary Green New Deal plans, which you discuss, utilize these concepts? And what aspects of climate justice are missing from these plans and why?
So one very important thing to put on the table first is that the Great Transition plans that I analyze in the first chapter, which continue to structure the ruling class response to climate crisis, the biodiversity crisis, and so forth, tend not to be framed, at least in the United States, as Green New Deals. Although there is a European Green New Deal, which is, it does adopt that framing in Europe. Now, what these proposals are essentially trying to do is to carry out a wide range of institutional and technical interventions that basically imagine, one, the fundamental continuity of hierarchy and often capitalist social relations, although I don't think they're necessarily attached to capitalism per se as a mode of organizing the society. Two, they basically envision ecosystem services and nature and also even the renewable transition as greenfield investments, as new arenas for exploitation and for accumulation. And whether that's the turning into commodities, ecosystem services, turning the carbon market into a real live way of supposedly dealing with global warming. This is something that's been attempted constantly since 1992, although with very limited success. Or for that matter, for kind of saying that the renewable transition in the global south should occur through what Daniel Gabor calls the Wall Street Consensus, which basically would rob third world states of sovereign control to change the terms of the investments that go into their country and basically lock in semi-permanent revenue streams for the governments and the bondholders and the investors in the north who would engineer these investments in the renewable transitions and basically to say, okay, this can be a new arena of profit. And this is very much actually particularly attractive within the European sphere where there are basically negative real interest rates. Right. And so there's a lot of capital that's so afraid of the risks of actually entering the financial markets, of entering investment, of entering the stock markets, that it's currently sitting on the sideline and in fact losing its value, losing the value of money is actually declining for Eurozone bondholders, for example. So it's about getting all that investment into more profitable arenas and actually creating the political institutional infrastructure and saying, okay, this climate crisis is a crisis, sure, but we can just use it as a new arena for the profit of big finance, monopoly capital, and so forth, right? So, I think it's self-evident that these proposals lack any sort of environmental justice aspect or just transition aspect. I mean, it's in their very nature, right? This is in the very nature of capitalism as a social system that is antithetical to justice concerns, that it is seeking to expel onto the socially vulnerable the ecological costs and the social costs of whatever internal contradictions that it wants to resolve. So obviously, for example, taking this example of the Wall Street consensus, if it's permanently robbing from third world countries the right to renegotiate the terms of the installation and profit streams to be derived from putting in place renewable infrastructure. And obviously these terms, as they would be originally imposed, would be highly injurious to third world states. They're going to overpay for them, and they're going to use technology. They're reliant on northern technology, which they often don't hold. And so if the balance of power shifts and they say, okay, well, we want to nationalize that, and that's actually a very common thing that third world states should want to nationalize northern investments, northern industrial installations, and so forth. I mean, this is the entire history of decolonization. If they should do so, then they would suddenly be vulnerable to suit in international tribunals. And this is similar to what happened in North America under
NAFTA. I'm struck by what you're saying about the injuries of the Great Transition, and also the history of nationalization of industries and its potential in eco-nationalism. So let's move now to eco-modernism, a central theme of your second chapter. You historicize ecological modernization theory by rooting it in Cold War history, and you also differentiate it from environmentalism. In the context of this discussion, one of the manifestos that you present, Full Automatic Luxury Communism by Aaron Bastani, proposes to mine the asteroid belt for minerals such as platinum and nickel. What do you make of such a science fiction proposition, and why is it relevant to your argument about leftist eco-modernism?
So these are not necessarily serious propositions in the sense that very few people, including NASA itself, are taking the more outlandish aspects of the eco-modernist left very seriously. Especially things like asteroid mining, pulling asteroids into near-Earth orbit, and so forth. Other aspects, of course, are taken extremely seriously. For example, he outright defends the Green Revolution, and there is currently a Green Revolution of sorts, although with horrible results, ongoing in Africa, for example. So it ends up being a defense of the socio-technological strategies of monopoly capital and the northern development agencies and so forth. So it actually ends up in defense of that. So there's this discourse has a mix of effects. Now, why is it allowed to be published, and what effects does it have on consciousness? Are, I think, the more interesting questions that we need to understand and address. Now, basically, these proposals are comforting, and they actually reflect the kind of ideological default, we can say, of people in the global north of a variety of social and ideological persuasions, but primarily somewhere who consider themselves somehow supportive of redistributive politics, but are not very comfortable with actually existing anti-systemic struggles, who carry with them the baggage of the historic Western Euro-American contempt for the peasantry, pastoralists, and so forth, the forest dwellers. And basically are ablated from the actual core struggles for social transformation and national liberation, which have always come from the periphery of the world system, which makes sense. The people who are most oppressed are more or less the most likely ones to demand the most revolutionary upheaval of the social system. I mean, we know this is just kind of almost arithmetic. right? And this kind of catatonic theology of modernization coming from Aaron Bastani, who doesn't know anything about ecology or much else, serves the function of maintaining this kind of progressive sectors as basically at a distant remove from the necessary social subjects of transformation on a world scale. And that is why that type of perspective is published actually in the New York Times. They said, oh, here's a luxury communist position. And it was published in the New York Times. It was very ridiculous. I mean, do you want to tell me that the New York Times is a herald of a communist revolution, or that this type of communism is actually the ideal type of communism from the perspective of the New York Times? This doesn't mean there's a conspiracy going on. They're like, they just say, okay, this is agreeable. Why is it agreeable? Well, it's agreeable because it's not centering Filipino peasants making 8 cents an hour or 8 cents a day, picking pineapples for American multinationals, right? That is not the type of non-luxury communism that would, that is not a type of communism that would be very attractive to readers of the New York Times and the publishers of the New York Times, whereas Bastanian hallucinations are comfortable for such publishers and such readers. And so that is why we see it in front of us as to why it didn't encounter a greater amount of friction and challenge. This is a very different question.
Nice. So let's stick with anti-systemic struggles. In chapter 3, you turn to energy use and degrowth. You also offer a definition of eco-socialism as the imposition of a different social logic onto the productive forces, the notion that energy systems should be run to balance the warring needs of avoiding ecological damage and providing necessary energy for human beings. Is this compatible with a program for what you term a worldwide energy democracy? Why or why not?
Absolutely. So any sort of energy transition, other than if you want to use wooden windmills to power civilization, requires extraction of minerals and highly elaborate industrial processes in order to build turbines and even to have run-of-the-river hydroelectric, which is very distinct from large dams, in order to build solar panels and so forth, right? So these are all going to incur ecological damages when the raw materials are extracted from the earth. There is no way around it. They are also capable of imposing ecological damages when they're installed. So both their extraction and their installation and subsequent use can produce distribution conflicts or class conflicts. And there's a lot of work going on that has been done about this, for example, in southern Mexico, for wind parks in India, very good work in Spain, in the area around Barcelona that's dealing with this topic. And so we know that just as the fossil extraction and distribution implies struggles over consequences, so does renewable energy. Now, does that mean we shouldn't shift to a different energy system? Or does that mean we should have social systems that do not rely on these industrial forms of energy gathering? Now, my answer to that is, of course not, right? And I think that's the answer of the overwhelming majority of the planet. I think everyone wants, more or less, with exceptions, wants electricity. The question is how to balance the costs of the creation of the machines and the installation and use of the machines versus people's desire for clean electricity. And that can only be such a balancing of costs can only occur in a serious way when you have an egalitarian political and social system that can make those decisions in a collective way and make reasonable tabulations of costs and benefits, not using the dollar sign, the dollars and cents to decide this is a cost, this is a benefit, but to be substantively rational and decide, okay, these are the prices that we are willing to accept as a society in order to have access to energy, right? And I think, you know, this way of putting the issue, this is, although I don't think it's, you know, I don't think I've come up with some sort of advanced conceptual innovation or theoretical innovation remotely in stating it that way. But I do think that posing it that way does not seem to be very common in a lot of the literature that I read on these topics.
So let's shift now from the worldwide perspective, worldwide level, to the level of the US and the legislature. You conclude chapter 4 in the first part of your book with an assessment of the problems of green social democracy. In this chapter, you contend with Naomi Klein's work, as well as the US Green New Deal draft legislation by Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Senator Edward Markey. How do you see green social democracy? And what are the key problems?
Green social democracy was and still is, although at this point it's a bit having a zombie existence after the failure of Bernie Sanders and Jeremy Corbyn, was basically a bid on electoral and legislative transformation to green social democracy in the North. And it was kind of a wager that this you could install ever more progressive legislators like Ocasio-Cortez or Jamal Bowman, and that we were also going to successfully elect Bernie Sanders and Jeremy Corbyn, and that they would then be able to hold these positions and implement legislation that would successfully carry out these forms of green ecological transition alongside a widespread downward redistribution of wealth within the Euro-Atlantic states. Now, this had a lot of problems from the outset, right? I mean, basically, it sought to replicate the post 1945 experience of social democracy in the European core and its Fordist cousin in the United States. And if you wanted to rerun that play, which is not a politics I support in the first place, one should recognize, of course, that those redistributive policy regimes took place when there was the threat of very different ways of organizing the social system that were real live historical alternatives, namely China and the Soviet Union and the national liberation struggles, which were occurring across Africa and Asia and then Cuba. And that these represented to a lot of people alternatives for how to organize society that did not reflect the continuity of monopoly capitalist forms of social organization. Now, those threats are not in place, and the kind of widespread insurrectionary atmospheres that occurred that were in place in Europe and the United States from the 30s onwards do not exist in the European core, I mean, and the United States right now. There's not a sufficient threat to compel the ruling class to accept widespread redistribution of wealth. So even accepting the terms of social democracy, which I do not, these were dead ends in the beginning. Furthermore, the very fact that if you are carrying out a process of accepting the continuity of capitalism, capitalism is a system of exploitation. I mean, you're extracting surplus value from workers, whether that's workers in the core or whether that's workers elsewhere. And capitalism as a historical social system has always been based on wealth transfers from the periphery, like from India, from the Indies, from Central America, from Latin America, from Africa. to the European states. I mean, that is what colonialism was. That's what neocolonialism was and is. And this is built into historical capitalism. So if you're accepting that, if you're accepting social democracy, you're also accepting that social democracy is actually a system for regulating rather than eliminating capitalism. And you're also accepting that there will be a softening of capitalism in the European core or Euro-American core without taking on the wealth transfers, the value transfers from the periphery to that core, is basically saying we are not interested in building an internationalist struggle at the outset. And again, this is not a politics that I subscribe to. And if it's that is the implicit politics, which was in a great deal of the chatter about a Green New Deal, and this is part of why I wrote the book to say, okay, let us simply clarify that there are different political projects, ambitions, and horizons that are contending for influence. Let us clarify the distinctions between them and let the chips fall where they may.
Value transfer is a concept that rings loudly with me. And I want to move now to the second and final part of your book, which features a passionate and comprehensive description of a people's Green New Deal. You address a range of sectors, from urban planning to transport and industry. You animate these discussions with insights on technology, from philosopher Ivan Illich, among others. Why do the conceptualizations from Illich appeal to you?
So Illich is a very interesting figure. Completely disinterested in socialism or communism, and not really using the vocabulary of imperialism, but nevertheless, Illich was stating in a very clear way that the technical systems, the technologies that are being selected for, installed, and implemented, spread, diffused at any given historical moment are not neutral, right? They are, at the time of their crafting, they reflect the interests of those who decide that they should be crafted. And then in terms of the patterns of their deployment and subsequent modification, they again reflect the existing balance of social forces in terms of how they are subsequently developed, unfurled, and then kind of locked in, and then restructuring social formations around them. So Illich really makes very clear that technology is not neutral. That it is, for example, he was interested in contemporary medicine. And as he pointed out, I mean, contemporary medicine in the West, while it has positive aspects, very much reflected the capitalist organization and the interventionist also orientation of the society and of the medical system. And so he was extremely critical of that. And that's why we have the types of medical systems that we do, which are primarily interventionist and reactive rather than community oriented and preventative, right? So I think Illich was extremely has been and is still ought to be read very carefully by people who are interested in understanding that technology is not at all socially neutral. I mean, there are certainly ways that technology can be recuperated for popular use, and Kalashnikovs can be used by colonizers and also against colonizers. And books can be used to spread reactionary propaganda, and books can also be used to spread the reading of Karl Marx and Lenin. So this is not to say that these are single-edged knives. The knives cut both ways, but they require struggles, first of all, to democratize and put these technologies under popular control. And furthermore, a lot of the technologies, it's going to be very hard to nearly impossible to do so, or they represent the preferred terrain of struggle, or the preferred mechanism of oppression in a specific context of power and powerlessness. And there are alternatives at play that are being suppressed in the very process of the implementation of a certain set of technologies. So I think this needs to be brought forward, so we don't just accept the kind of neoliberal or capitalist or Western myth that technology is an inherently neutral, or for that matter, that technology a new technology is inherently beneficial, and instead we should operate from a default of questioning the introduction of new technology, not to question it as a kind of atavism or to say that we reject it out of hand, but to say it's on you to justify why we should be adopting this technology. And this very much flusters people. People would be like, what do you mean we should justify it? And
questioning the justice of technology and these ideas around technology also bring to mind Gabriel Rockhill's work on development and technology as well. So penultimate question, your final chapters, A Planet of Fields and Green Anti-Imperialism and the National Question, draw attention to the centrality of agroecology in any Green New Deal, as well as the Cochabamba Working Group's position on restorative justice in the realm of climate debt. So what is your vision for dignified agriculture and sovereignty?
So if we look at any of the examples of successful development, successful meaning, let us say, successful in the very narrow sense of increased per capita access to certain goods necessary for survival or for a kind of complex life. We know that agriculture is absolutely central. It's always been central. Agriculture was absolutely central even to European industrialization. Agriculture has also been extremely central to the serious attempted development paths out of poverty that took place in the non-Western world post 1945, for example, China, North Korea. Agriculture was extremely important in contemporary Cuban resilience throughout the special period. Agriculture was put on the table with varying degrees of success in Venezuela, Bolivia, Zimbabwe. That is all the hot zones of our contemporary world system. And this is because agriculture is the only sector where you can actually extract endogenously a surplus. I mean, if you want to industrialize, and I'm very much in favor of a modulated industrialization, you need a surplus. I mean, you need access to technology, you need access to machine tools if you don't have them. You might need access to minerals, you need access to intellectual property, which if you're smart, you endogenize and pirate. But you need capital, both you need agriculture to get capital, and you need agriculture, first of all, to feed your population, sort of break through the food grain restraint. You need agriculture in order that you don't have to actually spend scarce capital on importing foodstuffs. And then if you have an excess of agricultural production, you can either sell it on international markets to get the hard capital needed for certain forms of developmental inputs, or you can do secondary processing on that, which is the basis of certain forms of industrial production. Now, there are actually no other alternatives, right? Which is also why this discussion about agriculture is repressed, because people, in fact, I think, don't really want there to be alternatives. But putting that to the side, agroecology, right, is a way of furthermore extending our notion of agriculture's central role in the developmental process, saying, first of all, we can have a greater surplus in the first place if at the farm level, if we reduce the input costs. First of all, so if we can work with natural fertilizers instead of inorganic fertilizers, then we have successfully reduced the cost, which increases on-farm well-being because you've increased the surplus available to the farmer. They no longer have to sell part of their produce in order to secure capital-intensive inputs. That's one thing. But another thing is that agroecology is can be a way of resisting perturbations that come from global warming, for example. For example, it produces an agriculture that's far more resistant to drought, to blight, to floods. And we know from widespread social scientific work and farmer surveys that have been done on agriculture during and after drought events, during and after hurricanes in Central America, that that agroecology, precisely because it is trying to mimic more closely or move more closely towards the functioning, how natural agro ecosystems function, is a lot more resilient than monocrop agriculture. So this kind of makes it a very necessary transition tool for our contemporary societies. And in fact, I was just reading an article 2 days ago about how regenerative agricultural methods are actually being widely used in Zimbabwe. And this is part, not all, but it's a part of how they have a record corn harvest this year. So it's very important for just transition within the world system. It also, instead of emitting, for example, carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, it actually allows agriculture to be a carbon dioxide negative element of our productive system. So instead of agriculture basically releasing carbon from the soil and turning it into carbon dioxide and actually contributing to the problem of global warming, you can actually use sustainable forms of agriculture to sow a great deal of carbon within the upper and lower layers of soil. You actually turn it into a natural solution to some portion, whether it's 1% or whether it's 20% of the climate crisis, right? So it's, I think it's absolutely central. It's also very central for biodiversity preservation, right? Because you're not using pesticides, you don't rip apart the traffic cycle. You don't rip apart the traffic web. You aren't carrying out this genocide of insects, which then ricochets up the food chain to causing massive damage to all the animals that prey on insects, including birds and reptiles. And so you end up with a much more regenerative agricultural system, which ends up preserving biodiversity while at the same time improving small farmer livelihoods and making the overall system more sustainable from a carbon cycle perspective, right? So there's a lot of positive effects that can be achieved and secured through a worldwide transition to agroecology.
That's an amazing discussion of agroecology and its cascading regenerative and economic advantages. Thank you, Max. So to wrap up today, tell us a little bit about what you're working on these days. You hinted at it in some projects in the bio, but it'd be great to hear more.
So I'm working on, I'm in fact working on three or four projects at the same time, which is not what I advise anybody to do. My dissertation work was trying to understand the role of smallholders and pastoralists in Tunisian decolonization and how Tunisian decolonization actually relied on the decolonization process that had occurred in Egypt, the nationalization of the Suez Canal, nationalization of a variety of foreign-owned industrial concerns and so forth, and also the peasant war, which was occurring in Algeria. And so I need to turn this into a book, which I'm working on. I have a huge amount of archives from the French gathered during their military occupation of Tunisia. And so I'm working on a manuscript, basically. This is basically about the Tunisian peasant war. That's one. And then I'm working on another research project, which is linked to the intellectual history of heterodox theories of development in the Arab region, but especially Tunisia in the 1970s and 80s. There was an agroecologist, Salah Din al-Amami, whose face and name were just added to the 5-dinar bill in Tunisia. One of the most important ecological figures that I have encountered in the third world, and he's very much unknown, including in Tunisia herself. And then I'm working on a critique of the planning process that occurred in Tunisia in the 1960s, and also trying to understand it as prophylactic against kind of more radical and anti-imperialist attempts at popular development, which were occurring elsewhere in the Arab republics during that period, alongside, which were marked by widespread, although still delimited, land to the tiller, agrarian reforms, and so forth. So those are the three projects. And then I'm also working on a kind of more theoretical update of a People's Green New Deal that is basically treating ecology and national development planning from a national liberation perspective.
That last project is very intriguing. Maybe in a future interview, we'll get to discuss that book. Max, Thank you so much for being on the show today. It was a great pleasure and privilege to speak with you. Take good care.
Thank you so much.